Hello, you're listening to Microbe Talk, the podcast where Laura and I talk about some of the times microbiology has been in the news this month. Even with the exciting news that we may be out of restrictions in June, we're still not going to talk through any coronavirus stories. It's in the news enough. So Laura, do you want to kick off?
The Telegraph published a story this month about some research covered in our very own journal, Microbiology. The story discussed a recent finding that bacteria on the skin of some frogs could protect against the chytrid fungus, Batrachochytrium dendrobatidis, or BD. BD is known to have caused 90 amphibian species to go extinct and is decimating frog, newt, and toad populations around the world. BD infects the skin of amphibians, causing the cells to break down. As the skin of amphibians is so important for them to get oxygen to their internal organs, BD infection can be deadly, effectively suffocating the animal. The research published in Microbiology investigated different strains of BD circulating in Costa Rica and aimed to identify what was so different about the frogs that were able to survive outbreaks of the fungus. They found that bacteria from the skin of these survivors could prevent the growth of BD in the lab. Often, the skin bacteria would only prevent growth of fungus strains that were seen in the same area, suggesting that this resistance is acquired locally. The researchers hope that they can use these protective bacteria to help control the fungus and protect amphibian populations when an outbreak occurs. BD has been seen here in the UK as well, according to the Telegraph story, and most Natterjack toads tested by the UK's Amphibian and Reptile Conservation Trust have the fungus present on their skin. For some reason, the fungus does not cause disease in Natterjack toads, but the effect of this fungus on other native amphibians is yet to be found out.
So my next story is about a similar group of animals, but this time it's reptiles, not amphibians, and it's a little more positive. Lyme disease is a tick-borne disease that occurs regularly in the Northern Hemisphere, but is particularly prevalent in the United States, affecting more than 300,000 people each year. Black-legged ticks, or deer ticks, are the creatures that spread the disease. They live throughout the USA, so you would think that Lyme disease cases would be fairly constant throughout the country. But scientists have found that cases in the Southeast are much lower than the Northeast, and they think they've discovered why. Researchers hypothesized that it was differences in the animals the ticks were feeding on prior to humans. Ticks pick up the bacteria that causes Lyme disease, a spiral-shaped member of the genus Borrelia, when feeding on animals like mice, deer, and lizards. To test the hypothesis, researchers conducted an extensive study of eastern ticks, including their abundance, behavior, and hosts, over 2 years. They found a clear divide in the preferred host and behaviour of ticks south of Virginia, matching the pattern of both tick infections and Lyme disease. The difference appeared to be tied to the choice of one host in particular. In the Northeast, the ticks prefer to feed off small mammals like the white-footed mouse, which are known for transmitting the Lyme disease bacteria to the ticks. But in the South, the ticks prefer to feed on lizards, particularly skinks. These are known as being poor transmitters of Lyme disease pathogens, meaning fewer southern ticks are infected, leading to fewer people getting sick. Another interesting point comes from a previous study by the same researchers. It's not just the host choice that differs in the north and the south, it's also the seeking behaviour. As it's much hotter in the south, the ticks stay under leaf litter to avoid dehydration, whereas the ticks in the north are much more outgoing, climbing up higher onto leaves and twigs, where they're much more likely to encounter and bite humans. This kind of makes it a double whammy, as the ticks in the north are more infectious and more likely to bite you.
Researchers at the University of Cardiff have discovered a new antibody which helps the immune system target human cytomegalovirus, or HCMV. HCMV is quite a common virus and affects around 1 in 200 newborn babies in the UK. The virus hides from the immune system, causing lifelong latent infection, similar to herpes virus, for example. Although infection is usually harmless, HCMV can cause severe disease and even death in some people who are immunocompromised due to HRV or undergoing an organ transplant, for example. The Cardiff group, led by Dr. Richard Stanton, have discovered a new antibody that marks cells that are host to the virus rather than the virus itself. They used proteomics to characterise the molecules on the surface of HCMV-infected cells and used immunological screening to identify targets. These antibodies alert the immune system to the virus, allowing it to activate and kill the virus in a process called antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. Next, the team hope to test the antibody to see if it is effective and safe to use in people, and they hope that the proteomics technique that they have used could also be applied to other things like cancer, tagging cancerous cells and making them targets for the immune system. The way that it works is the antibody will stick to the host cells that have the virus inside of them. This means that the host immune system can identify which cells are infected and attack them.
If you've been following our YouTube channel for a while, you may remember a video that we published years ago about self-healing concrete. It was full of microbes that would fill any cracks that appeared in the concrete. This story isn't just about concrete that contains microbes, it's about whole bricks completely made out of fungi. According to the United Nations Environment Programme, building materials and construction account for nearly 40% of humanity's CO2 emissions each year. So the race is on for scientists and engineers to find a more eco-friendly alternative. Mycelium, which is the fibrous roots of mushrooms, are carbon neutral, as well as being lightweight, durable, moldable, and naturally fire-resistant. It's these attributes which have led to a growing number of eco-minded entrepreneurs to look at fungi as an alternative, environmentally friendly building material. To build a mushroom brick, mycelium is combined with some kind of agriculture waste, like straw or corn husks. It's then grown for about 2 weeks, in which time the fungus will fully colonize the straw, and then the fungus is killed by heat or chemical treatment. At this stage, it's pretty much exactly like a traditional brick, only made of organic material instead of clay or concrete. But that's not all. In theory, you could grow the mushroom bricks into any shape you wanted, even a full building. So currently the method involves killing the fungus. Making them into a building would require you to keep the fungus alive, which has the additional benefit of being self-repairing. If you accidentally put a hole in the wall, you could just grow the fungus to fill the hole. Fungi are truly amazing organisms, and people aren't just using them for building materials. Companies like Dell and IKEA have started using mushroom-based packaging, and Katie Ayers, who lives in Nebraska, recently unveiled an 8-foot-long, fully usable canoe. It's completely made of mushrooms and took her just 2 weeks to grow. It's amazing what people are coming up with.
In the Sunday Express this month, Microbiology Society member Dr. Tina Joshi of the University of Plymouth discussed the threat that antimicrobial resistance poses. The article discusses the tidal wave of bacterial infections that are becoming increasingly difficult to treat with antibiotics. According to the piece, antibiotic-resistant infections have increased by 50% in just 5 years, with 93,654 cases of infections resistant to antimicrobial treatments in England last year. Tina Joshi warns that overprescribing of antibiotics is contributing to this increase and suggests that healthcare services could do more to slow the rise of antimicrobial resistance. She suggests a number of changes, including changes to cleaning and hygiene protocols in hospitals. Some bacteria are now becoming resilient to certain disinfectants. The diagnosis of infections to ensure the correct antibiotics are used. Because, for example, in some cases, antibiotics which target bacterial infections are given to people with viral or fungal infections. She goes on to explain the responsibility of policymakers in protecting antibiotics and ensuring that future generations will not be missing out on life-saving medical procedures due to lack of treatments for antimicrobial-resistant infections. I found this article really important and valuable. It explained the importance of antibiotics underpinning medical treatments such as cancer and surgeries, as well as bacterial infections, and explains the current Public Health England guidance around when antibiotics should be prescribed. The importance of completing a full course of antibiotics rather than stopping taking them when you start to feel better is key for us and the rest of the general public to make sure we do our bit in preventing the rise of antimicrobial resistance. Public Health England have also issued guidance to GPs, telling them not to prescribe antibiotics to treat things like earaches, coughs, or sore throats, as these typically aren't even caused by bacteria and tend to go away on their own.
My next story is about a bizarre blob-like motion of microscopic creatures that may give clues to early animal movement. Researchers studying single-celled organisms called coanoflagellates noticed something pretty strange. The microbes are generally rigid, but when they got trapped in a tight space, they started to move very strangely. Their external flagella disappeared, and parts of their bodies began to push out, forming bubbles called blebs, and they were able to squeeze into new spaces, sort of like jelly pushing through a maze. Because coanoflagellates are close relatives of animals, this research suggests complex movements first evolved in the ancestors of both groups. It also supports the idea that animals first evolved from an ancestor that resembled coanoflagellates. After the initial observation was made, researchers put the coanoflagellates through different workouts. They used different ways to confine the coanoflagellates, or coano as they've been nicknamed, including placing them in chambers with both narrow and wide areas. Each time, the microbes became blobs that shimmied and crawled to escape, and could even switch between crawling and swimming to get out a tight squeeze. It's interesting as these two behaviours are reminiscent of those seen in animal life today. Animal cells come in two basic forms. Microscopic animals come in two basic forms. One is a flat sheet of epithelial cells that have an up and down orientation, like the cell of a swimming coanoflagellate. The other form is more three-dimensional and includes more free-form cells that settle into specific spots to become organs. The new work demonstrates that coanoflagellates can be both types. This ability to switch back and forth may have been critical as early animals began to explore new environments. Eventually, organisms evolved the ability to form the different types of cells at the same time in different parts of the body, setting the stage for complex multicellular organisms. As usual, there's a lot of debate. Which came first? The ability to develop into an organism with lots of cells, or the ability to produce different cell types? By studying coanoflagellates, researchers are hoping to learn about the organism that gave rise to both coanoflagellates and animals.
And that's all we have time for this month. I hope you've enjoyed the episode. And if there's any news stories that you see that you think we should cover on Micronews, do feel free to tag us on Twitter at microbiosoc. Thanks for listening.